didn't check to look at the beginning. And as you can see, it sort of pretty much sorted itself out. Except, wasn't it working? Oh, there we go. Just want to check
the text spoken by the voices and the.
I was a bit unsure about the sound level, so I just wanted to check that.
The text spoken by the voices and the sound.
Okay, stay still.
Right. Okay, I think I will launch straight into it. Right. I'm sure you're all familiar with the famous Rorschach inkblot test. This is, you know, a bat or an angel or a demon staring at you and trying to be scary. And the title of the talk is Rorschach Audio. Subtitle of the book is Rorschach Audio, Art and Illusion for Sound, which is a reference to another book, Art and Illusion, which I'll talk about later. And what to say about that? I mean, the book, by way of a blatant sales pitch, 10 quid, covers a lot more stuff than, you know, a much broader subject area than is described specifically in the talk. So the talk's very much introductory, and there's lots more entertaining material that you come across in the book if you're interested. Okay, the title of this talk, Rorschach Audio, is taken from a text written for CD for a compact disc. It's taken from a text written for sleeve notes of a compact disc called The Ghost Orchid, subtitled An Introduction to Electronic Voice Phenomena. And for those who might not be aware, electronic voice phenomena are a class of allegedly mysterious vocal recordings. And while several explanations have been offered to explain their origin, the majority of EVP researchers believe that their recordings literally constitute physical evidence of contact with the afterlife. In other words, EVP researchers mostly believe that it's possible using various radio and electrical engineering techniques to literally record the voices of ghosts. Now, implausible as that might seem, inventors Edison and Marconi both believed in the possibility that radio might enable contact with the afterlife. So EVP researchers like to think that they're in sort of esteemed and serious scientific company in that respect. And that idea sits well in context of Victorian enthusiasm for various forms of spiritualism. However, the EVP movement proper began in 1957 when Friedrich Jürgensen, who was an artist who previously painted portraits of Pope Pius XII, found voices intruding on recordings he'd made of his own voice and then of birdsong. Convinced that these recordings represented communications from aliens, and for instance from his deceased mother, Jürgensen temporarily abandoned his artistic career to concentrate on his experiments and to publicise his findings. In 1960, he started recording similar voices with radio equipment as opposed to just tape recorders that he'd used previously, and published the books Rosdana van Rindem, Voices from Space, 1964, Sprechfunk mit Westerbeeren, Voice Transmissions with the Deceased, 1967, and Radio och Mikrofon Kontakt mit der Dode, Radio and Microphone Contact with the Dead, in 1968. Now, from 1968 onwards, Jürgensen cemented an increasingly close relationship with the Vatican, making a number of documentary films about religious themes and executing further portrait commissions for Pope Paul VI. Jürgensen's publications, and particularly the idea that he'd amassed evidence proving the existence of the afterlife, attracted considerable media attention. Now, another psychologist, Konstantin Raudive from Latvia, took up the cause of EVP research, allegedly making tens of thousands of recordings. And through the publication of his book Breakthrough, specifically publication in English of his book Breakthrough in 1971, Raudive became the leading light in an international circle of EVP enthusiasts. Now, today, the movement that Raudive and Jürgensen effectively founded has evolved into a very widespread activity of such complexity that it would be difficult for anyone to really attempt a truly comprehensive survey. I mean, some people have estimated figures of tens of thousands of active EVP researchers on the basis of membership of different EVP societies around the world. How reliable those figures are, I've got no idea, but you'd be amazed how many times you come across EVP research if you look in the right places, and EVP research has been quite relentlessly plugged in certain sections of the media, mainstream media. So the purpose of my talk is not to attempt this kind of, you know, like an overall survey of this, but to address the major salient issues which recur throughout EVP research, and which in fact underpin the entire belief system. My talk will argue that EVP represents a classic example of the supposedly strange phenomenon, for which there is indeed a perfectly rational explanation, but perhaps somewhat counterintuitively also suggests that critical discussions of EVP can be really surprisingly rewarding and valuable. This is because, despite my initial scepticism and, to be honest, belief that exposing the central fallacy involved in EVP is really a statement of the obvious, i.e. they're not really recordings of the voices of ghosts, right? I now believe that it can also be shown that EVP recordings provide evidence of psychological phenomena that are inherently interesting and even important from the point of view of sort of psychology of perception. Similarly, studying how this evidence has been turned into a complex and often quite entrenched belief system is also of anthropological interest, not least because, paradoxically, this process entails the use of the products of scientific research, electronic technology, to help construct, rationalise and to validate a fundamentally anti-scientific belief system. Now, the presentations that I'm, all the video clips and so forth that I'm about to present in this talk will also be used to support a secondary hypothesis, which is that an understanding of the processes involved in EVP may also contribute something to theories of art criticism, both in general terms and with particular reference to music and to sonic art. Because the ideas on which these hypotheses are based are, in fact, already embedded in mainstream critical arts theory, and in fact trace descent from the artist generally recognised as the most important figure in the history of Western art. What's most surprising from this point of view is that not that these ideas exist, but that in this kind of context, like sonic art in general, they've previously been largely ignored. So, to kind of get into the main narrative here, my first exposure to examples of EVP was when I was at school in the 80s, hearing a flexi-disc of voices recorded by Konstantin Radovay, which was published around 1982, if I recall correctly, by the Unexplained magazine, which is a magazine that does lots of features on UFOs and Bigfoot and all this kind of stuff. And the style of these recordings, which you'll hear in a minute, is typical of EVP. The narrator introduces ghostly contacts, which manifest as very brief bursts of distorted voice, accompanied by high levels of radio interference and machine noise picked up from the recording apparatus by a microphone, i.e. the kind of grinding of the mechanism inside the tape recorder. Typically what the EVP researchers would do would be to, at least in the old days, would be to have an open reel tape recorder on a desk, and they'd roll out a microphone cable like this and kind of basically have a kind of spiritualist seance, and they'd call out and hope that sort of stuff would be recorded, and then on playing back the tapes they would find that sometimes things hadn't been recorded. Sometimes they kind of wedge a little diode into the input socket of the tape recorder, which is quite interesting because that effectively turns the tape recorder into a radio, without going into the technical details. But okay, so that's the voices manifest as brief bursts accompanied by high levels of radio interference and machine noise picked up from the apparatus by a microphone. The examples are repeated several times. This is usually quite important. And the ambience of the recordings is quite menacing. My initial reaction to hearing this material was one of disbelief, because, as I said before, I have instinctive scepticism about any claim to the existence of the supernatural, but also because, somebody who's always been interested in kind of electronic music and so forth. The unfortunate truth is that it would be pretty easy to fake up material like this if you know anything about, even sort of basic tape recording and overdubbing techniques. So, the most primitive tape recording and overdubbing techniques could easily produce recordings of this nature, not least because, and this is quite a serious point, and I'll explain more about this later, the more basic the technology you use, the more the finished product would resonate with an aura of menacing low-fidelity mystique, which can paradoxically even help lend a subjective impression of authenticity to such material. So, I think that's quite interesting. If the voices recorded were of similar quality to hi-fi studio recordings of speech, perfect, crystal-clear recordings, then nobody would have ever believed they might have been ghosts, even for a minute, right? And it's paradoxically because the recordings are quite poor quality that, encourages at least some listeners into sort of, temporarily suspending disbelief. However, having said that, I'll also describe why I now believe that some EVP researchers have perfectly genuine motives, and that many of the signals they recorded are not consciously faked, but are instead commonplace and completely physically real material phenomena, phenomena, however, whose origin and nature they've misunderstood. So these are the sort of classic recordings that were reissued by the Unexplained magazine and were originally published as a 7-inch record, which was given away free to journalists in order to promote Radivé's book Breakthrough in 1971. Here we go.
The text spoken by the voices and the sound volume are exactly the same as in the original recording. To help the ear adapt itself to the strange rhythm, rapidity and softness of the voiced entity's speech. Each utterance is repeated several times. The voices here selected are grouped according to the persons addressed and their respective answers, followed by a translation and explanation. They are examples chosen to give the reader a breakthrough, an acoustic illustration of the material presented in the book. The listener is asked to read any text spoken in languages he does not know, with particular attention, so that he may be able to grasp each separate word phonetically. Please note the commentary that goes with each voice text, as the meaning of some utterances can only be understood in context with the situation that gave rise to them.
The first voice is that of Margareta Petrowski, who had told the experimenter during her lifetime that she did not believe in an existence after death. After her passing, the experimenter asked her how she felt in the beyond, and a voice, identified as coming from Margareta, answered, "Bedenke, ich bin." German, imagine, I am. Again we hear Margareta Petrowski's voice, this time calling her former employer, Dr. Zenta Maurina. Zenta. Now the experimenter asks if Margareta can hear him, and the voice replies, Kostya, ja. German, Kostya, yes. The voice then calls the experimenter's family name, Raudive, but shortens it to Raudiv. And now we hear in Latvian and German, Koste, tu tik na. Koste, you are so near. Now the experimenter calls the Russian poet Vladimir Mayakovsky, and the voice answers, Mayakovsky. The experimenter tells the poet how difficult it is to convince people of the reality of the voice phenomenon, and in reply comes a statement which is typical for Mayakovsky's personality. Konstantin, pluj. In Russian, Konstantin, spit on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, this is a fairly long record, so it's just a small introduction. excuse me. The idea that EVP could be described as authentic phenomena and that explanations do exist to account for how they arise is drawn from several sources. So, for instance, the neurologist Oliver Sacks, who wrote great books like Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, all this kind of stuff, discusses the subject of acoustic projection in his book Seeing Voices, describing the so-called, quote, eye music and phantasmal voices experienced by the poet David Wright in his autobiographical book Deafness. Having lost his sense of hearing in childhood, after the onset of spoken language, David Wright found himself able to experience reconstructed sound images projected by his mind into his perceived environment as an extension of visual information. Lip reading triggered actual voices inside David Wright's head, despite the fact that no environmental sound was being provided by his ears. The projecting effect was so strong that David Wright even reported hearing ghost sounds conjured by the motion of trees in wind. He explained that, "My deafness was made more difficult to perceive because from the very first my eyes had unconsciously begun to translate motion into sound. My mother spent most of the day beside me and I understood everything she said. Without knowing it, I'd been reading her mouth all my life. When she spoke, I seemed to hear her voice. It was an illusion which persisted even after I knew it was an illusion. My father, my cousin, and everyone I've known retained these phantasmal voices. That they were imaginary, the projections of habit and memory, did not come home to me until after I left the hospital. One day I was talking with my cousin and he, in a moment of inspiration, covered his mouth with his hand as he spoke. Silence." Now, David Wright's faculties may sound extraordinary, but what I hope to show as a result of further demonstrations is that his experiences are in fact extreme manifestations of the capacity for projection that not only manifests in all senses in all people, able-bodied or otherwise, but which also influences the whole process of perception. So, for instance, a psychoacoustics demonstration known as the McGurk effect, which has it's been shown on TV and there's a good video of it on YouTube and stuff like that, so you can easily find it online if you want to look at this again later, or maybe some of you have seen it already. The McGurk effect refers to an experiment in which test subjects were asked to describe what they'd heard after watching videos of a face reading monosyllables. Okay. The sounds they heard were modified by the visual information provided by the face. In other words, when you watch this video, you experience a form of acoustic projection similar to that described by David Wright. When the video is dubbed, so the face says gar, but the voice is replaced with the sound bar. Listeners describe hearing the syllable dar, which is acoustically midway between gar and bar. Now, that sounds a little bit confusing. So what you initially hear over the top of an otherwise blank screen is a replacement soundtrack where the syllable bar has been placed on the soundtrack, so to speak, artificially edited onto the soundtrack afterwards. Then the face becomes visible, and the lip reading that you, the sort of interpolation between the visual and acoustic information that you would make inside your mind as a result of lip reading, causes the bar to be misheard as a sound more similar to da. In fact, the original movements that were recorded in the video, for which the soundtrack has been taken out, were producing the sound ga. Okay? So this looks quite strange, this video, when you watch it, but it becomes most interesting when you realise that the sound you hear during the actual part where you see the speaker's head changes slightly depending on whether or not your eyes are closed, open or closed. So that, is really the most interesting part of this demonstration. Excuse me while I jump forward.
Arbeiten. Arbeiten.
Back to the beginning.
did.
Okay.
I think we have to
come on to the text spoken by the voices and the sound volume are exactly the same as in the original recording.
There you go.
To help the ear.
Okay,
ba,
sorry.
Ba, ba, ba.
Sorry about that, folks. Right.
Ba, 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 ba. 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 Ba, 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 ba.
Okay, so...
Should
everyone have a go
at closing their eyes, Jim?
Okay, right. Okay, so...
Low five.
Seems you all got on reasonably well with that one, I think, judging by the kind of responses we were getting there. Among wartime experiences described in his autobiographical novel, The Periodic Table, Primo Levi, the industrial chemist Primo Levi, recalls a laboratory apparatus called a heterodyne, which under certain conditions, not dissimilar to how you kind of modify equipment in EVP experiments, functions as a radio. He described, quote, an intricate universe of mysterious messages, Morse tickings, modulated hisses, deformed, mangled human voices which pronounce sentences in incomprehensible languages or in code. During the Second World War, this is messages of death, the radiophonic babel of war. And it's perhaps not surprising that studies of this whole sort of confusing sound world also provide some interesting clues to help understand what's going on with EVP. Okay? So, Olive Rainier and Vladimir Rubinstein's book, Assigned to Listen, states, like Oliver Sacks, that the mechanism of projection plays a major part in hearing. Assigned to Listen describes the ether war, so-called, fought by BBC foreign language radio monitors, who scanned the Second World War's, quote, remorseless sea of noises, the broken voices, coded messages, news, propaganda, disinformation and entertainment broadcasts that fought for bandwidth with the incessant vagaries of ionospheric propagation and the turbulence of electrical and magnetic storms. These BBC monitors recorded often very weak transmitted sounds onto primitive Ediphone wax cylinder transcribers, so they didn't even have magnetic tape recorders at this stage, and used versions of the old wax cylinder recording devices that were in fact sold as commercial dictation machines for use in offices. So the monitors recorded often... Sorry, I'm repeating myself. And this degraded the quality of discernible intelligence to the point at which the problems encountered start to converge with the kind of issues familiar to photo reconnaissance analysts and to restorers of antique paintings, i.e., you know, the kind of issues about, you know, to what extent are your interpretation of ambiguous forms faithful representations of the original signal and to what extent are they projections of your own imagination. The need to reanalyze these voice recordings over and over again to detect traces of meaning in a dense fog of background noise is virtually identical to some EVP research techniques, but Assigned to Listen makes no mention of ghosts. Assigned to Listen states that, quote, projection is the mechanism by which we read familiar shapes into clouds or melodies into the monotonous rattle of a train. In a similar way, we can read speech into a medley of noises. Leonardo da Vinci advised painters to practice their imagination by looking at cracked walls and reading fantastic scenes into strange patches, the book says. An important lesson of the BBC monitor's wartime experience was that they should not be too dogmatic about sort of saving a difficult interpretation. You know, you've been listening to something for ages and you think you've worked out what it means, and you know, because the other stuff doesn't really work in that context, you kind of try and push it into, you know, force it to make sense. They stressed instead the importance of admitting failure when necessary and of discarding incorrect hypotheses, unsentimentally chucking incorrect hypotheses, even if a great deal of effort had been invested in their formation. And bear in mind,
you know, the political significance of some of the material they're working with, the high seriousness of some of the work they were doing, meant that they had a kind of extra motive for trying to make sense of this material. So if one of the BBC monitors thought that he or she had finally made sense of a distorted voice, only to find its apparent meaning contradicted by the other sounds that followed that sequence, they should not try and force the square peg into the round hole out of sheer frustration. They should instead relax, staying true to the axiom that tiny bursts of information are inherently easier to misinterpret than large bursts of information, and trust that their inability to interpret a larger sense showed that their initial guess had, in fact, always been wrong. The whole comes before the part. It's apparently a sort of axiom of Gestalt psychology. So they should instead formulate a new hypothesis and test that until it too was either discarded or proven. We'll return to this subject a little bit later. So these experiences tend to support a statement by Michael Handel, who is interestingly a historian of military intelligence and deception techniques, that, quote, another piece of advice based on psychological tests is not to put too much confidence in conclusions drawn from a very small body of consistent data, because conclusions drawn from very small samples are highly unreliable. So, to put this in context, the Assigned to Listen book states that, quote, 6 or 10 syllables may answer to all sorts of different projections, but 30 or 40 syllables are much less likely to trick you. So the kind of criteria that they considered to be reliable was 30 or 40 syllables, whereas, as we've heard, typical EVP recordings often involve no more than 3 or 4 syllables. With regard to the next demonstration, in 1996, a Scientific American article by Sean Carlson described an experiment by Diana Deutsch, who's a professor of psychology at San Diego University, and which demonstrates how acoustic projections of the sort that I just discussed can be explored in controlled conditions. And this is one of the most fun parts of the talk, when I was talking about comedy value earlier on. Diana Deutsch recorded a person, in fact herself, speaking 2 neutral words, and created a sequence in which the voice samples were reproduced in alternating stereo channels. Okay? Played back fast enough that the sounds remain recognisable as voices, while scrambling their actual meaning, the sequence produces, quote, a pattern that sounds like language, but the words are not quite recognisable. John Carlson continued, within a few seconds of listening to this strange cacophony, my brain started imposing a shifting order over the chaos as I began hearing distinct words and phrases. First came blank, 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 then time, 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 then no time, long time, and any time. I'm still quoting here. I was then astonished to hear a man's voice spinning out the right-hand speaker only. In a distinct Australian accent, it says, take me, take me, take me. So, this is the point at which I brought up the title for this project. The inkblot test, devised by the psychiatrist Herman Rorschach. It's another picture of Brad Pitt. naturally springs to mind in this context. And it's interesting, joking aside, to see that in a standard university psychology textbook, written by the American psychologist Henry Gleitman, has some examples of Rorschach inkblot tests. But by way of illustration, the 3 interpretations that Henry Gleitman ascribes to these sample inkblot tests are, quote, a head-blowing smoke, but also a ghost and an angel, the last 2 being projections that very strongly resemble the emotional agenda of the EVP recording. I regret to say that's coming out in mono, so it's not really working. Yeah. Sorry about that, folks.
That might not be possible to fix.
Yeah, so it's not really going to work, I'm afraid. Anyway, I'll play it anyway, but the projecting effect would be much more vivid. I'm sorry, if it was in stereo.
That's
Okay. So, how did people get on with that?
It kind of evolved during.
Yeah. I mean, it excuse me. The effect kicks in much more rapidly if you hear the kind of stereo version. But I realised when I was listening to it myself that it does kind of build up progressively. You know, unsurprisingly, if you listen to that continuously for about 20 minutes, it works a lot better than if you just listen to it for a couple of minutes like we had there. But, you know, there are a couple of points to bear in mind about that is that the sensation, that there's really three levels of sensation involved in that experiment, and this analysis applies to the mono version as well as the stereo version, in the sense that the first impression that most people get is that the sound's kind of drifting about a bit. You know, as you said, evolves. You know, the second level of illusion, a sort of higher level of illusion, perhaps, is that the phonemes, the syllables, start to vaguely resemble certain words. You know, which I'm sort of moderately confident most people have had some version of that experience just now. The third level of illusion, which is much rarer but much more striking, and does require people to listen to it for a lot longer, is that it really sounds like somebody's whispering in your ear. And that's quite difficult to achieve. But the interesting thing is that all three of those experiences are illusions, not just the most dramatic and rarest manifestation of the illusory faculty. The drifting itself, even at the lowest level, just that sense that, you know, that the sound is evolving and sort of maybe forming into different, slightly different shapes, is itself an illusion because the material is completely repetitive. Anyway. As the Assigned to Listen book says, projections have a way of sticking to a sound. And in fact, in contrast to the flexible and diverse projections that are produced by listening to material like Diane Deutsch's recording, and experiments of this nature have been produced by a whole bunch of different experimental psychologists, going all the way back to B.F. Skinner in the 1930s, the preemptive narration typical of EVP recordings tells listeners in advance how to interpret these recordings, as you heard with the initial sequence, creating a false sense that the meaning comes from outside of that individual listener's imagination, and therefore an illusion of a shared experience. And then, it really is a shared experience, but by virtue of that, an illusion of objectivity. Because, you know, the preemptive narration fixes a certain interpretation in people's minds before they hear the material, when in fact it would be more appropriate to run some kind of blind test and sort of assess whether or not different listeners are agreeing on the interpretation of that subject matter. Transmissions from across the entire radio spectrum share a tendency to drift away from their original broadcast frequencies and to spontaneously demodulate onto amplifying circuits, as in fact all amplifiers within radios can function as broadband very low frequency receivers, VLF band receivers.
Microphone cables can also function as VLF antennas. So, for instance, when EVP researchers had their reel-to-reel tape recorder there, often outdoors, and rolled out a long microphone cable to record, in Jürgensen's case, birdsong, the microphone cable itself acts as a radio antenna, which draws electricity from the atmosphere back into the recording apparatus. And particularly old and primitive or cheap recording apparatus can demodulate signal, electrical rather than acoustic signals, which that equipment was not really designed to pick up. So, especially when they're unshielded and used outdoors, taxis, police and ambulance, air traffic control, maritime, military short, medium and long wave commercial broadcasts, TV voice channels, radio ham experiments, CB radio, bugging devices, conferencing systems, intercoms, baby alarms and analogue mobile phones all share a tendency to emerge in this same VLF waveband, frequently producing these kind of stray signals. These stray signals are well known to PA operators, people who set up amplification systems for concerts and so forth, people who install in-car entertainment, and wildlife recording engineers, and these people employ a whole arsenal of electromagnetic shielding devices specifically to eliminate this kind of interference. But when stray signals are heard, they're often very, very distorted and garbled, and therefore they make ideal raw material for acoustic projection. Some EVP researchers have attempted to exclude these stray signals using metal Faraday cages. However, most EVP techniques require not the removal but the addition of extra noise to the basic input in order to improve the success of EVP recordings. This is a consistent pattern. Radiostatic, deliberately mistuned voice transmissions, especially in languages not understood by the researchers, audio oscillators, microphone feedback and recordings of foreign language courses, birdsong, fountains, hissing taps, rain and surf are all used. Deliberately adding noise to improve EVP recordings may seem counterintuitive, but there are a whole group of psychology experiments which demonstrate both the strength of the preemptive prompting effect and the importance of adding noise. So, for instance, the psychologist David Bruce, quote, recorded a set of ordinary sentences and played them in the presence of noise so intense that the voice was just about audible but not actually intelligible. He told his listeners that these were sentences on some general topic, such as sports, and then asked them to repeat back to him what they'd heard. He then told them that they were to hear more sentences on a different topic, which they were also to repeat. This was done several times. Each time the listeners repeated sentences were appropriate to the topic which had been announced to them in advance. When at the end of the experiment David Bruce told them that they'd heard exactly the same recording every time, all he changed was the announcement. Most listeners were unable to believe it. Similarly, another psychologist called Albert Bregman from McGill University in Canada prepared a demonstration, I'll show you in a second, which shows how adding noise to interrupted speech recordings can actually help the mind to partially restore the missing information. A very sort of interesting psychoacoustic phenomenon. So in the following sequence, alternating 1/6 and then 1/4 second long sections of a spoken sentence have been replaced by silences, with the effect that the sentence is made almost unintelligible, so it sounds like another sort of effect. There's a comedian who does a routine called the broken microphone trick, which is basically essentially what I've just done just then, but a lot funnier. The silences are then replaced with bursts of white noise, which is very similar to radio static, coincidentally. Most listeners report hearing a continuous stream of speech with the illusion of that continuous speech appearing to run underneath and through these bursts of white noise, and to run, in fact, throughout the entire recording. The interpolative and restorative faculty demonstrated by this illusion is completely compatible with evolutionary biology, since in evolutionary history, it makes sense that the mind would have been able to evolve mechanisms, would have had to have been able to evolve mechanisms to restore continuous streams of audio information. You know, imagine you're listening out for a scream in the distance or listening out for somebody's voice. You know, those would be streams of audio information that are interrupted by noises. But until the invention of modern audio recording technology, the mind would never have had to have evolved an equivalent means to restore speech that's been interrupted by a silence. Okay, so let's try this one.
Fence effect with speech. Player set the picket fence effect with speech.
We play a sentence in which half of the sound has been eliminated by taking out every other 1/6-second segment and replacing it with a silence. Then the same sentence is played with loud noise bursts, replacing the silences. Does this make the speech sound more complete? Finally, you will hear the intact sentence.
Utterating out is an odd group of sound. The principle of similarity is very important. Utterating out is an odd group of sound. Utterating out is an odd group of sound. Principle of similarity is very important. Utterating out is an odd group of sound. Principle of similarity is very important.
Again, half the speech is deleted, but this time every other quarter-second segment has been deleted. Again, judge the apparent completeness of the sentence.
Utterating out involves grouping sound. The principle of similarity is important. Utterating out involves grouping sound. The principle of similarity is important. Utterating out involves grouping sound. The principle of similarity is important. Utterating out involves grouping sound. The principle of similarity. Auditory scene analysis involves the grouping of sounds. The principle of similarity is very important.
You know, one of the interesting things about that demonstration is it actually works slightly better with the longer gaps, in my opinion.
Especially the second half of the sentence.
Yeah. And, you know, really that's the least subjective of all the demonstrations that I give this evening. You know, there's much more of a sort of individual variation in people's subjective response to the different sort of psychoacoustics clips, but that's really the sort of most rigidly reliable in terms of the nature of the illusion that it produces. As for prompting, you know, in the context of EVP research, the psychologist Philip Rubin develops a technique called sine wave speech, which involves creating computer-synthesized simulations of the major energy bands or formats in real speech recordings. And this is a technique which I like to compare to the sound design for the children's TV show The Clangers from the early 70s, which is actually a non-trivial comparison. They're basically created using very similar techniques, except this one's computerized. And in The Clangers, they copied a kind of written script using so-called piston flutes, trying to actually simulate the words in a written script. Okay, I'll read that bit again. As for prompting, the psychologist Philip Rubin develops a technique known as sine wave speech, which involves creating computer-synthesized simulations of the major energy bands or formants in real speech recordings. As you'll experience for yourselves in a moment, on first hearing, the meaning of such sine wave speech is usually quite hard to discern. After, however, you've heard the natural voice recordings from which those sine wave speech clips were made, and then, afterwards, hear the sine wave speech recordings again, much more accurate perceptions of the original meaning suddenly kind of jump out from what were previously quite unintelligible sound patterns. So this is quite an interesting demonstration. There's bound to be somebody who's actually seen the website that Medical Research Council that I pinched all these clips from, appropriately credited, and probably knows them already. Okay.
I thought the last word sounded a bit like hurts.
Yeah, not far off, but it's even funnier than that.
She ironed her skirt.
She ironed her skirt.
Guesses?
Museum.
Yeah. Maybe this is a sort of context thing to do with Museum of Natural History.
The police returned to the museum.
The floor was quite slippery.
was going to swear then.
It's quite separate.
Anyway, I think it does quite clearly demonstrate that if you have sort of foreknowledge of a particular viable interpretation that could be subjectively or objectively attributed to a particular speech sequence, it greatly, dramatically changes the way you interpret it when you hear it. Interpreting all this evidence en masse, the implication seems to be that rather than there being anomalous and occasional events, we are perhaps unconscious of the extent to which projections like this take place continuously as an inherent part of normal perception, as opposed to being sort of illusions that people characterise as being things that you might experience in a laboratory or looking at a psychology textbook or in context of a lecture like this. In fact, these illusory faculties, so to speak, contribute something to normal perception. And that might sound a bit strange, but I'll explain. This paradox is particularly well illustrated by the blind spot phenomenon in visual perception, in which the mind, so to speak, copies and pastes information from surrounding areas of the visual field to fill in and cover up the surprisingly large section of the retina which is completely blind to visual information. So there's a section about 6.5 degrees wide in your visual field that is completely blind, and if you've ever done the experiment, you can make a dot on the page by focusing on it in your peripheral vision disappear quite easily. And of course, with a bit of sort of careful setting up, you can even get a person to disappear in the distance or even an oncoming vehicle. So, the blind spot phenomenon is sufficiently critical that it's actually a very important factor in road safety. You can get objects to completely disappear in the visual field. But, of course, we don't experience that on a day-to-day basis, a subjective impression that there's anything missing from our visual field, right? The paradox is that the continuous visual field, that continuous visual field that we experience day-to-day, is itself partly an illusion. But it's an illusion that we experience as reality, point number one. And point number two, it's an illusion that we rely upon to enable the successful and safe navigation of external reality. So the kind of argument I'm putting forward here is that the ability of the mind to kind of compensate for the blind spot illusion relies upon the mind's ability, not terribly well put, to generate very powerful and convincing illusions on the fly that actually contribute something to normal perception. In his treatise on physiological optics of 1866, Hermann Helmholtz categorised perception as unconscious inductive inferences, which, despite very heavy reliance on memory as well as on direct sensation, quote, come about with immutable certainty at lightning speed and without the slightest meditation. So, that's not really consistent with most people's perception of what you think of as being illusions. These perceptions come about immediately and contribute to what we perceive as being real. Okay? Helmholtz's theory of what he termed perceptual hypotheses, in sort of technical language, suggests in plain language that what we experience as reality is in fact partly intelligent guesswork, that much of what we experience as reality is in fact intelligent guesswork, So, with hearing as with vision, and as particularly as demonstrated by the blind spot phenomenon, and particularly in hearing when speech is distorted or obscured by noise, the mind makes use of creative guesswork to actively construct the best available representations of external reality. Normally, this guesswork generates perceptions which agree with a whole spectrum of different inputs from vision, from touch, from taste, from smell, and from memory. So, therefore, we're only aware of the process of projection, the extent to which illusions contribute towards perception. And especially the imaginary and subjective aspect of this perception, when that projective process very occasionally generates perceptions which disagree with that whole spectrum of other inputs. And it's only those very rare mistakes that we consciously recognise as having been illusions. Now, the advice that BBC radio monitors should formulate, test, and then accept, refine, or discard projected interpretations of unclear sounds is very similar to ideas proposed by the scientific philosopher Karl Popper. Karl Popper proposed the usefulness not of absolute scientific truths, but of self-refining feedback loops in which what he called working hypotheses a progressively formulated, tested, and then discarded, modified, or accepted according to whether or not they're supported by experimental and observational evidence. You know, the theory of working hypotheses basically emphasises the importance of intelligent guesswork in scientific research. Psychological projection is discussed in detail in the art theorist and historian Ernst Gombrich's classic monograph, Art and Illusion, hence the subtitle of the book. Ernst Gombrich quotes Leonardo da Vinci's famous advice to painters, but it's particularly interesting because he quotes the final sentence of this passage, which is often omitted from texts on art. Quote, according to Leonardo, "You should look at certain walls stained with damp, or at stones of uneven colour. If you have to invent some backgrounds, backgrounds for a painting or a portrait, you'll be able to see in these the likeness of divine landscapes adorned with mountains, ruins, rocks, woods, hills, plains and valleys in great variety. And then again, you'll be able to see their battles and strange figures in violent action, expressions of faces and clothes, and an infinity of things which you will be able to reduce to their proper and complete forms. In such walls, the same thing happens as in the sound of bells, church bells, in whose stroke you may find every named word you can imagine." The illusions that Leonardo da Vinci described are closely related to the demonstrations you've experienced during this presentation. And the plot twist that we finally get round to is that it was in fact Ernst Gombrich, author of Art and Illusion, who was the supervisor of the BBC, the listening section of the BBC Monitoring Service, who wrote all of the material about acoustic projection that I quoted earlier on from the book Assigned to Listen. The Assigned to Listen authors themselves quoted Gombrich's original material from an internal BBC memorandum entitled Some Axioms, Musings and Hints on Hearing. And in that memorandum, Gombrich summarised his ideas as being the story of an army signaller who, quote, misheard the urgent message, send reinforcements, I'm going to advance, as send three and fourpence, I'm going to advance. you know, it might sound trivial, but, you know, psychology of interpretation is, in fact, extremely important in military communications, police communications, emergency service communications, military intelligence, as well as scientific research. As regards art and illusion, it seems important in this context to emphasise the influence that, in fact, relatively little-known wartime intelligence work with sound had on what is arguably the most important work of visual arts theory ever published, which is Gombrich's book, Art and Illusion. But what's most surprising about that is that while the influence of Leonardo da Vinci's advice on figurative and abstract painting is probably inestimable, is one of the most famous quotes in the world, from the point of view of fine arts practice, Leonardo's final sentence about sound seems to have been almost totally ignored. In Art and Illusion, interestingly, Ernst Gombrich also mentions his friendship with the philosopher Karl Popper before he came to Britain in the 1930s. So, you know, it's the sort of comparison between the methodology that was evolved in the BBC Monitoring Service and Karl Popper's sort of proposed working methods seems to be non-coincidental. Incidentally, Karl Popper's methodology also seems to have embodied similar working principles to those embedded in the circuits designed by Alan Turing to decipher the Enigma codes in World War II, another aspect of military intelligence work. The Alan Turing character depicted in Hugh Whitemore's admittedly sort of fictionalised, but nonetheless, his play Breaking the Code, that's the title of the Hugh Whitemore's play about Alan Turing, spoke of, quote, building a machine which could sense contradiction, of how contradiction implies any proposition, and of electricity that flows through the related hypotheses. On a more strictly factual level, that is strictly factual, actual, but it's not actually, but it's not Turing's original words. It's a fictionalized version of Turing's actual theories. According to Alan Turing's biographer, Andrew Hodges, the Enigma code-breaking process, quote, depended on the flow of logical implications from a false hypothesis. So you are using a false hypothesis in order, so to speak, to, you know, fight your way towards the truth. And this concept has interesting parallels with the recommendations in Assigned to Listen. The psychologist Gyorgy Kepes characterised perception as an active and inherently creative process. We create this projective material which helps us to navigate the real world. By implication, therefore, perception is also an artistic process, arguably. And Diana Deutsch, whose material you heard earlier on, suggested that perhaps, as an artist, Leonardo, quote, may have been particularly susceptible to such transformations of sound, because perhaps this faculty is associated with extreme creativity. In London, however, there's a traditional folk poem that describes ordinary people hearing similar illusions in the sound of church bells, oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clements. You know, so I think it's quite important to emphasise that this isn't, as a question of emphasis, something that's the sort of exclusive preserve of people who have unusually high levels of creativity. It's actually about, you know, an intrinsic and commonplace psychological faculty. Karl Popper stated that, quote, there are no uninterpreted sense data, while Ernst Gombrich stated that there is no reality without interpretation. And I draw this talk towards its close. There's one little thing I'm going to add at the end, after the punchline, by agreeing with the idea that at a fundamental neurological level, many of the faculties exercised in basic forms of perception and in the formation of scientific hypotheses and in the appreciation of art, in fact, have a surprising amount in common. With regard to electronic voice phenomena recordings, I'd also agree with the psychologist Richard Gregory that after the death of a loved one, quote, sights and sounds are commonly misperceived as evidence of their return. And I'm certain that many people will confirm that such perceptions can be profoundly moving. But Richard Gregory's observation can nonetheless be offered as a global explanation for EVP. So, finally, if the style and content of this talk seem to be a bit of a harsh appraisal of phenomena whose creative impetus we know stems from an instinct that all of us share, which is the desire to triumph over the tragedy of human mortality and retain contact with lost friends, then I'd like to suggest that the fundamental message of any statement which undermines faith in the afterlife, and which in doing so promotes or reinforces essentially atheistic-type beliefs, remains as always the same. And that message is the most romantic notion that humans ever conceived, and it's advice that remains profound no matter how clichéd or it becomes or how often people repeat it, which is to make the most of the living and seize the day. So there's one final thing I'd like to demonstrate, because we've got a couple of minutes left, is... in my sort of capacity as an artist, I produce a video installation called The Analysis of Beauty. The Analysis of Beauty is written by the artist William... It's a book written by the artist William Hogarth in 1753, which is all about the intrinsic beauty of what we nowadays call sinusoidal waveforms. A few wavy lines like this, so unsurprisingly the video features wavy lines, right? And the reason it's relevant to show this video in context of this talk is because it's a very good illustration of how perceptual hypotheses operate in the visual realm, and the illustration of Helmholtz's concept of perceptual hypothesis explains important aspects of visual perception. What you have with this video is a whole bunch of twisty wavy lines that are sort of forming on a screen, originally an oscilloscope screen, but it's been videoed for the sake of this presentation. And the form that you see on the screen, when you look at it, can appear to solidify into a three-dimensional object. It's completely fat, but it can appear to sort of form into what appears to be a kind of luminous rope, kind of twisting around slowly like this. This is a well-known, well, not terribly well-known, but known to psychologists as this illusion as the kinetic depth effect. Kinetic because you don't see the illusion when the material isn't moving, but when it starts moving, you start to see the illusion. And quite vivid sensations emerge, perceptions rather, emerge of solid three-dimensional form, that you're actually watching a rotating object. Now, sometimes you're looking at it and the object changes, starts rotating in the other direction. Sometimes it appears to be flat, sometimes it appears to be solid, sometimes it appears to be moving to the left, sometimes it appears to be moving to the right. Sometimes it appears to be kind of different streams that are weaving in amongst each other, and then suddenly it turns back into an object again. And sometimes these changes occur because you think about it in a different way. Sometimes the changes occur because you tilt your head from side to side. Sometimes because you might blink, and this sort of resets your mind's interpretation of the information that's available to it. These sensations of visual depth form, despite the fact that there's no object precedence. There's, you know, depth perception is normally determined by closer objects obscuring other objects that are further away, right? Object precedence. By geometric and aerial perspective, vanishing point perspective, geometric perspective or aerial perspective, whereby moisture in the atmosphere building up gets mistier in the distance. So you perceive things as being far further away because they're in the mist. That's aerial perspective. Motion parallaxes, you know, are real-world practical knowledge that we've acquired about how objects behave, move relative to each other when we're moving through visual space. And stereoscopy, you know, 3D films are, the sensation of depth produced by watching 3D films is produced by sending two different, slightly different images to the left and right eye. The kinetic depth effect illusion is a form, in a sense, a form of kind of 3D video, which relies on absolutely none of these. None of this information is present in this video, but despite that fact, you still perceive quite striking illusions of three-dimensional form. And thereby demonstrating the role of, or the formation and, in fact, the sort of contradiction of perceptual hypotheses in contexts where there's no other corroborating information to sort of force you to interpret the information in one way or another. Anyway, I think I've described that well enough. I'll just try and bring up the video. The original telescope screen that you're seeing filmed there, so obviously the image is a lot crisper than the original, but even on a relatively poor quality video, you should be able to get some kind of reasonably convincing kinetic depth effect after you've looked at it for a little while.
Oh,
we
just changed the picture, didn't
we? And, you know, the thing to sort of bear in mind with this, that the changes that you may or may not, hopefully will experience watching the video aren't taking place on the screen, they're entirely taking place inside your own mind. Happy with that? Okay. The end. Thank you very much.